Namato Ratanatayasa. Okay, so welcome everyone. Today is the session on insight meditation. And I hope it's not indicative that we have a very small turnout today. I suppose it's just a scheduling thing. Because one would think that meditation to see the truth or come to understand oneself would be a very popular thing. So we'll have to see, maybe this time slot is not so good for people. But we have a very large audience on the internet, and so recording this, and it will be put out as an MP3. And added to our new website once it's all working. The Buddha Center has a new website, and that there will be a notice put out about that, I assume, within about a week, once it's all set up and verified. So today I thought I'd talk about what insight meditation is not. I give it just a little brief introduction as to what insight meditation is. It's become an accepted category of meditation or type of meditation in Buddhist discourse. And the word insight, of course, means to see clearly or come to understand something. And in this sense, we mean to understand reality, to come to see clearly and understand experience, understand ourselves, understand our lives in a clearer way. And it's worthwhile talking about what insight meditation is and so on, but today I thought I'd go the other route, because I assume there's a lot of people both here and listening on the internet who are already practicing meditation. And I think often we can get stuck on things which are not insight meditation, not meditation which leads to enlightenment, that they are not enlightenment experiences, and yet we seem to, we for some reason think that they are. So I'll be going over some of the traditional categories of things which are not considered to be enlightenment or insight. And altogether we have here a list of 10 of them. So I'll be going over these in a fairly brief synopsis in about a half an hour, and then there'll be questions after that. So the first thing to say is that these 10 things are not bad things. They are not things that we are to try to avoid during meditation practice. In fact, quite the opposite. They're things which most meditators, when they obtain one or several of these good things, pleasant experiences, they feel overjoyed and are incredibly encouraged in their practice by the attainment. And that's really where the problem lies, is when we take something that is simply a pleasurable, enjoyable experience and give it more importance than it really deserves. And of course, this is a theme that runs through insight meditation from start to finish, is we're never to give anything more importance than it deserves, or make more of something than it actually is. And so it's because these are good or pleasant or enjoyable experiences, enjoyable phenomena itself, that they come to be what we call corruptions of insight, something which weakens one's awareness, one's power of focus and understanding, that fuzzies and blurs the distinction between reality and illusion, and dullens our senses, our ability to perceive things as they are, because we start to become partial to these experiences. And so they're good things, but they're things which we have to be able to let go of as the Lord Buddha said, it's like a raft. When you have a raft and you use it for getting across a river, once you get across the river, you don't then put the raft on your back and carry it along with you. You leave it there on the shore and continue on your way. So when these experiences end, we don't look for them or strive for them any longer. And so I'll be explaining these 10 in a little bit of detail. The first one is called obhasa, which means brilliance or illumination. And this is common for people who practice in intense and intensive tranquility meditation or transcendental meditation, Hindu meditations and so on, visualization meditations, where the meditator, after practicing for some time, comes to see a great light, even with their eyes closed. And without even wishing or wanting for it or looking for it, suddenly a meditator, even when they're practicing insight meditation, will come to get this sort of brightness in their mind, like behind the closed eyelids, as though, and often this is what it seems like, as though someone had opened the door, as though the sun had just come up from behind a cloud, as though someone had even lifted the roof off of their hut, off of their room, and the sun was shining down. That's often what it feels like, or often what it seems like, that there's this great light that could only be coming from something like the sun, which is shining through. For other people, there will be pictures or colors. For some people, there are just dots of light, orbs. In fact, there's a whole meditation school that is based on this visualization of a crystal ball or so on. And so it's because this sort of an experience is something new and something totally unrelated to everyday experience, it's very easy to get the mistaken idea that this is somehow a super mundane state of experience and somehow how indicative of enlightenment. And in English it's even easier because of the course of the word enlightenment, which we somehow think that it has to do with illumination. That's possible to have that misunderstanding. This got so bad at one point in Thailand, and it's even pretty bad right now. There was this great, late, great teacher of a very famous tranquility meditation technique who taught people to focus on a crystal ball, first at their nose and then going into the center of their head and then going down to their stomach. And this was really an easy and something that everyone could practice quite easily. They didn't have to have any understanding of Buddhism or any desire to leave behind their everyday lives or their ordinary way of existence. There was no need to change. All you had to do was focus on this light. And so it became very popular, to the point where this teacher became one of the great famous teachers of Thailand. And even today his meditation is practiced now around the world, and it's thought to be somehow a new understanding of the Buddha's teaching that you can become enlightened by focusing on a crystal ball. But the truth about this teacher is, as I've heard it, is that he went to practice insight meditation later on in his life. And I've seen the letter he wrote to the meditation center where he practiced. It's a meditation center that I've taught at in Bangkok. And it was also very famous during that time. And he went to practice there, and when he saw the light, they had him say to himself, seeing, just reminding himself that it was an experience of vision. And at first it was just an overwhelmingly pleasurable experience. But then finally, once he let go of that, and when he was able to sit with it in the very reality of it, it disappeared. It just vanished suddenly, and while he was observing it. And ordinarily, if you're not paying attention, this doesn't mean much. But in insight meditation, it means an incredible amount. It means it's a very profound experience to suddenly realize that absolutely everything which you hold dear, which you hold as important, as valuable, has this potential to just cease on you. And it's something that you can't just explain it and it suddenly makes sense. You have to experience it. When you see these things ceasing like this, it's an incredibly shocking experience, and it leads to higher stages of insight knowledge, the next one being knowledge of danger or knowledge of fear. You have this incredible shocking experience that wakes you up and allows you to realize that these so-called wonderful experiences are actually ephemeral and unsatisfying. So after that, he wrote this long note about how this insight meditation stuff was really the true teaching of the Lord Buddha, and he was so happy that he had come and so on. But of course, his students, as it seems, did not listen, and they're still have all these strange and funny ideas about how to become enlightened by visualizing this or visualizing that, and then when you can see this, you become enlightened to this level. When you see that, you become enlightened to that level. And there's a lot of funny stuff. You can find some of it on the internet. But this is an example of how far it can go, where people can actually think they're enlightened simply because of something that they see. And of course, there's no relationship between simply a visualization and an enlightenment. It's something that is nice to see these wonderful things, but in the end it comes down to an experience of seeing. It's nothing more, it's nothing less. This is the first thing that insight is not. The second one is mindfulness. And we talk always about mindfulness as a good thing, but it can actually become, in the early stages, a hindrance. Because people, when they start to be mindful, of course, remember the word mindfulness means to remember. So they, first of all, they find themselves able to remember the present moment very well. This is sort of the reason why the mind calms down and these pleasant experiences arise. And that in and of itself can give rise to conceit. It can give rise to an overestimation of oneself, and it can give rise to laziness. Once you start to really be mindful and you find yourself able to acknowledge everything very well, it's very easy then to become lazy and to think you've somehow attained a state of being which is going to last and is going to stay. And as a result, the mind immediately becomes lazy and ceases to put out the effort that was required to maintain the level of awareness. Moreover, the remembering that arises during the meditation can often include the past and the future. So through the meditation practice, some people are able to remember things that happened a long time ago that they had forgotten. People are able to make plans about the future. And they're able to remember and to have a clarity of mind that they didn't have before, whether it be in regards to the future, the past, or even the present moment. And the key here is there's a misunderstanding of this as somehow an enlightenment, where we may have gone through a meditation course and we had this great mindfulness while we were there, and we think that somehow that means that we are now enlightened. And then when we come out, of course, it's a real shock for us that this mindfulness also goes away. And eventually we're back, if we're not careful and if we're not continuously mindful and continuously developing our mindfulness, it can easily return us to where we started. The third one is called knowledge, or insight. It's given sometimes a name insight, the word jnana, which means knowledge. And this refers to some of the things I was talking about on Tuesday, where we get an intellectual understanding of the truth, where we come to consider impermanence, we consider suffering, the unsatisfying nature of everything, and we understand, come to understand non-self, how things are not under our control. But we understand it on an intellectual level, and this becomes enhanced through the meditation practice, of course, because our concentration is so sharp and our mind is not overwhelmed by the unwholesome states of mind. So it's very easy for us to think and to ponder over the Dhamma and to really come to an intellectual appreciation of it. We start to think that, yes, it's true, everything in this world is impermanent. When I was young, I was like this, and then all that's gone now. Yesterday it was like this, now it's like this. Or something disappears and we say, oh, everything's impermanent. It's incredibly true what the Buddha taught. And any aspect of the Buddha's teaching we think about, suddenly we have this, what feels like a profound understanding of it. And it's worth saying that this is a product of good practice. It's worth saying that all of these things come about only because one is practicing correctly. If one is not practicing in a proper manner, none of these corruptions will arise. But once we get to this sort of low state or preliminary state of understanding things and appreciating them on an intellectual level, it's very easy for us to then think that this is somehow the summum bonum, or the highest state. And simply appreciating the Dhamma on an intellectual level then becomes sort of like a goal that we have attained. And it's very easy for us to then become lazy. This is, all of these things again, as well, are technically considered, the name is understanding what is not the path to be the path. Makka makka yana tasana, seeing what is not the path and what is the path, or misunderstanding what is the path and what is not the path. At this time we're trying to gain an understanding of the difference between, or what things are the path and what things are not the path. Intellectual understanding and appreciation and discussion and debate and study and so on are not the path, are not the way of insight. So sometimes this is one other thing that can often be mistaken for true insight. The next one is faith. And this one, I think, is, we come across a lot in the various schools of Buddhism, where people have gotten a sort of superficial understanding of the teaching, and maybe a profound understanding on an intellectual level, but have not done a great amount of practice to realize for themselves. When they get to a certain level in their practice, they get this incredible amount of faith, and this faith comes to everyone. But there are many people out there who, when they obtain this faith, they then somehow think that they overestimate themselves, and they think that now they have come to some state of enlightenment. And so they then go out and they're willing to argue with anyone, debate with anyone, and to tell everyone else how they're all wrong, and to try to teach everyone they meet. They want to teach, they want to explain, and it comes from a very good intention. We have this great intention after we practice to help other people, to show other people this wonderful thing. This is very common in meditation retreats. It's very common in religion in general. Once we find some good thing, when we adopt a new religion, people who are born again Christians, they feel such happiness and rapture believing in Christ or believing in Buddhism or meditation or however, that they then want to go out and proselytize and to show to other people. Well, on the surface, it's a good thing to want to help other people, but it's very misleading and it's very dangerous as well, because it's very possible that this faith could be based on something that is not the path, that is not the way to enlightenment. At the very least, it becomes a corruption of insight, because the meditator, rather than putting out the effort necessary to continue on the path and to progress on the path, they become lazy and become content with what they have gained. With this great amount of faith, it's a substitute for us, in many cases, for knowledge, for understanding. where we believe or we're sure of ourselves. It can get to the point where we're absolutely sure that we are enlightened, that our teacher is enlightened, that the Buddha is enlightened. And yet we haven't become enlightened ourselves to be in a position to judge or to realize or to understand that. So not that faith is a bad thing necessarily, it's actually a fairly neutral thing, but it can be dangerous if it's based on something, or if it's not based on personal and direct experience. The next one is called rapture, and I've talked about this before. Rapture is this state of static charge, which can come through the meditation practice, through intense concentration. Some people will sit and find their body swaying back and forth. Some people will feel very light, feel like they're floating. Some people actually do float, as they say, with their bodies lifting off the floor. There will be incredible states of pleasure and exuberance, states of goose flesh. Some people laugh, some people cry. There are cases of meditators crying for hours and hours on end without even knowing why they're crying, without any reason, without feeling sad. This is a state of static charge. It's I often would liken it to, explain it as a like when you put water into a cup. The water that we put into the cup is like the concentration that we gain through the meditation practice. But once the cup is full, as you keep practicing, more concentration comes, and as a result it overflows. And so all of these things, crying, laughing, swaying back and forth, floating in the air, are an excess or an overflow of concentration. And there's nothing wrong with them, but it's very easy to become addicted to these experiences. Some people swaying back and forth every time they sit down and practice, and not realizing that that there's a subtle attachment or addiction to the experience. The next one is called tranquility. And I think perhaps this is the most common problem that I encounter with meditators, especially those who have been practicing on their own without a teacher. For those people who have never had a teacher and go and practice on their own, the most common point or experience that they'll become stuck, they will become attached to, is this state of peace, quiet, calm that arises. And it's often explained as a kind of a profundity or a vastness, emptiness. It's often thought to be this elusive state of emptiness that we're all trying to attain, or this understanding or experience of emptiness. Well, of course, the word emptiness can mean many different things, but in classical Buddhist discourse, it doesn't mean a feeling of emptiness. The feeling of emptiness is just this tranquility. It's the fact that the mind is very focused, is very fixed, is very quiet, is very calm, that there's nothing coming up to disturb the mind. And so this is one point where I'd put a specific emphasis on the importance of understanding something for what it is. And when you feel this state of nothingness, this is where people are unable to continue because they don't know what the correct response is. And the correct response here in the tradition that I follow is to treat it like you would anything else. When you have this state of nothingness, you think there's nothing, and so you don't know how to react. You feel like there's no object for you to pay attention to. You pay attention to the emptiness, you pay attention to the nothing, to the quiet, to the calm, and you focus on it just as you would any other experience, because it is an experience, it is a phenomenon, it's not nothingness. It's not nothing, it's nothingness, it's not nothing, it's something. So you focus on the calm, and you would say to yourself, calm, calm, just using it as a meditation object, coming to see it simply for what it is, not seeing it as a state of enlightenment, a special state, an important state, not giving it any more importance than it actually has intrinsically. This is the number one, I think, that we have to watch out for, and we have to realize it's not insight, it's not wisdom, it's not a substitute for clear awareness and understanding of reality. though it of course comes as a result of meditation practice. The next one is happiness, and this is well less common, and it generally comes at one point or another to the meditator where they feel totally at peace with themselves or just happy about practicing meditation. It's a happiness that is not associated with an object, with seeing this or that. It's just a general happiness from the meditation, from being happy to be sitting in meditation, the happiness which comes from a clear mind, from freedom from liking and disliking, attachment and aversion. And this as well is something good. These are good things which come to the meditator at the lower stages, but they're not a substitute for the higher stages of understanding of impermanence and the unsatisfactory nature of the things in the world, and the ultimate understanding of our inability to control these things and to take them as ourself. Moving on, the next one is called energy and effort. And this comes to certain meditators. Through the practice of meditation, you gain a lot of strong and fixed and firm effort and energy. But for some people, it can become a real hindrance, and a hindrance in the sense that they start to take it up as their practice to put out more and more effort. People who do walking meditation all night. I've heard stories of monks who claim to be enlightened simply because they didn't feel tired anymore. And I think it's a wonderful thing to hear that someone could practice to the point where they don't feel tired anymore. This indeed happens, and that's what this state is referring to. But it doesn't mean that person is enlightened. It means that they've attained a special state of existence where they're no longer tired and they can practice day in and day and night. It's easy for us to misunderstand states like this as the path, as the way, as something to be pursued. I've even had students who would go running around the monastery. They just couldn't stop. They would have this incredible energy where it just picked them up and they had to run with it. And running around the monastery with the monks and the people in the monastery watching them. And so this, if we're not careful and mindful and if we don't understand it simply for what it is, it's easy to misunderstand it and to think that somehow we're now enlightened as a result of this. Number 9 is equanimity. And equanimity is a difficult one to pin down because it is the highest state which we're hoping to attain. But here, this sort of equanimity is not really paying attention or not really understanding things as they are. It's just a sort of a superficial feeling of not caring, of disinterest, not wanting this or wanting that. It's a good thing. It's on a level which we might not get to if we hadn't practiced meditation, but it's not on the level of paying direct and clear attention to things and still not finding any sense of attachment or aversion to them. This one is a heightened state where there's no more liking or disliking arising in the mind. But those states can very easily come back as we start to focus on the object. And we can see that it's actually not very refined. It's simply a formed state which comes to us in the mind that, I don't want anything, I don't want this, I don't want that, I don't have any more wants or needs, and I don't really feel aversion towards anything. And so it's very easy to identify with and come to think that somehow we are now enlightened. At all stages, even at the higher stages, this becomes a problem later on when true equanimity arises. It can still become a hindrance because the meditator feels true equanimity for all things and comes to just experience things as they are and comes to think that, well, now they've made it to the top and there's no further to go. And so they, at that stage as well, lessen their effort. Stop pushing to reach higher states and thus are not able to finish the path, are not able to reach the goal of the path. because of not putting out enough effort. And the number 10, so first of all of the first nine, these are the real good things that arise. And the reason they are problems, as I've said, is in the first sense because we misunderstand them and think of them to be the path, to be the way, to be some special or super mundane experience. Now the number 10 is an attachment. It's this subtle attachment. It's not exactly greed, though it is based on the same unwholesome mind state. It's a very subtle sort of contentment with any one of these states. So not only do we misunderstand them, we also become subtly attached to them. And this is said to be the number 10, or the 10th and final phenomenon which we're to watch out for in the meditation, that is not a replacement for insight, and is a danger, a corruption of insight, something which is going to keep us from progressing to the higher stages when we hold on to any specific state. It could be any one of the other nine. It could also be some sort of sensual experience, something that we see, something that we hear, something that we smell, taste, feel, or think. And it's very subtle, so it's very difficult to catch. And in general, it's associated with one of these subtle experiences. So this is something that I would normally explain to people who are undertaking a meditation course. I don't know how many of you have actually come across any of these states, but at any rate, it's a good thing to be aware of, that when we practice meditation, we're looking specifically for a clear awareness and understanding of the things that are coming and going, arising and ceasing. We're not looking for any special, magical, mystical, extraordinary state. The extraordinary state, what we're looking for, is an extraordinary understanding, acceptance, and detachment or non-attachment to things as they come and go, to the reality which we're faced with. So that's the teaching that I thought I'd give today. Thank you all for coming, and hope to see you all again. Can you describe more why it could be not so good? It's basically, you're specific here. Okay, if I show a friend a path to meditate. No, these are things which get in the way of our meditation. So our obsession with teaching other people can very easily and very often and very frequently does get in the way of our meditation practice. When we're, even though we're sitting in meditation, we're still thinking, oh, I've got to show this to my father, I've got to show this to my mother, I've got to show this to my brothers, I've got to show this to my friends. They're going to love this. This is great. That is a very common hindrance on the path. Because it's like a mental distraction. Yeah, mainly distracted by that. It also doesn't generally have the great results that we think it does, trying to offering to teach other people meditation. The best way to spread Buddhism is as an example. When people see that we are not clinging, that we are not suffering because of the fact that, because of the things that they are suffering from, then they want to know how we do it, and they want to know how they can come to that state, and it comes about more of an example. Yeah, you can feel this sort of thing when people approach you with their religion. It doesn't even have to be religion. I've been approached by socialists. I've been approached by other Buddhists who can be very dogmatic. I'm thinking about in Thailand, actually. There are some sects, S-E-C-T-S in Buddhism, and in Thailand, and you get this very same feeling that there's something wrong with them inside, that they somehow need for you to accept their way of life. And to me, it shows a real lack of true experience and realization. It shows that they're still wavering in their own faith, so they need everyone else to. They can somehow affirm their own belief by having other people join them and take up their way of life. That's how I see it. I think someone who truly has gained experience and realization, especially in, of course, in Buddhism, they don't really have a need for other people to appreciate it. There's not this lacking inside of them that leads them to chase after other people. And it's really a disturbing thing to have other people chase after you anyway. It doesn't have the desired results. So you find that the great teachers are not this way. That someone who has become a famous teacher, it's because they're not that way. They're willing to accept anyone, and anyone who comes to them, they're willing to give them the opportunity to make the first step, to come in on their own, to join, to take up the practice on their own. Let them take the initiative. It's a real empowering thing to give someone the choice, which is something the Buddha was great at. When people wanted to become his disciples, if they were like big and powerful people, he would say, "Be careful. People like you should always make a careful investigation before you run into anything. You're a smart person." And of course, they would say, "Wow, now I'm, twice as keen on joining you." Oh well, you can thank the Buddha. Cyrus, being that all experience are elusive and one should remain, what are some of the pitfalls you have personally faced, some of the states you've wrongly attached to, if any? Oh, just about all of them, I suppose. I mean, I came into Buddhism not knowing anything. I went to Thailand, and I sat around my uncle's apartment watching the Godfather movies and drinking and smoking marijuana with him and his friends. And I went to practice meditation 5 days after the New Year on the year 2000. Of course, on the eve of the millennium, we were all in our reverie. And then 5 days later, I was right away into meditation. So it was a bit of a shock, to say the least. I remember experiencing these great rapturous states where you shake back and rock back and forth. I thought that was really neat, and I was doing that all morning, just rocking back and forth, until my teacher said, "That's not cool. That's not something to be clung to," and he had me stop that. Crying, I remember crying for hours. Lights. These lights are, it's really interesting how you can actually think that someone opened the door and you have to open your eyes and look. I mean, they're pretty common for beginner meditators, I think. I mean, this is something that we as teachers are always, we keep this list in our mind, and we're always watching for them, because they're the classical things that people get fixed on, get stuck on. After a retreat I experienced the lightness that you referred to. That can be quite scary as well as liberating. How do you ground yourself? You mean feeling lack of weight, that sort of lightness? Well, you accept it for what it is. You don't have to, there's no reason to try to be anything but light. If you're light, you're light. The problem is there's the misunderstanding that it's somehow going to last, or the fact that it's still there is a bad thing, or somehow we have to do something about it. This is, I think, a good way to explain just about every experience, that in generally we think we then have to do something about the experience. And that's always the problem. Is that, oh, now this experience came up, and oh, now I have to do something about it. There's some response that I need to give to it. And that's patently not true. The response which we should give to it is an understanding of it for what it is. And that's why we use this mantra. It's just a way of affirming for us, it is what it is. So when you feel light, you just say to yourself, light, light, or floating, floating, or whatever the good word is. Something that captures it for you in your mind, this is what it is. In what I practice, we observe sensation. When feeling light, one's body seems void of any sensation. It can be unsettling. So then you focus on the feeling of being unsettled. That's a worrying sensation or a fear sensation. You focus on, you say to yourself, afraid, afraid. Reminding yourself of what that is. Unsettled, confused, or you know, however the actual unsettling thing is. It's not unsettling. Your mind has a state, a judgment state. Which it doesn't have to be a defiled state. It could just be, I've never experienced this before. I don't know how to react to it. So you focus on that, not knowing, unsure. It's a sankhara, as you probably know of it in your tradition. It's a thought. It's what you think of something. Sankhara is the khanda which judges and which thinks of, which has thoughts on objects, what you think of something. So it too is something to be observed, exactly. Okay, well, we've got a 30-minute meditation at 1. I was just going to, I'm probably going to give out a notice to Buddha Center regarding the Sutta study on Saturday. I'm thinking it'll be on the mindfulness, the sutta on the great foundations of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness. I'll put out a notice about that. Tomorrow I'm not on the schedule, but from 1 to 3 I'm going to set up a schedule to meet with meditators, people who are practicing on their own, maybe just want someone to talk to, or would actually like some advice on their practice. In my kuti, so from 12 to 3 I'll try to be around the computer, and if anyone shows up at my kuti, my hut, I will come on the computer and we can sit and talk either in text or in voice, sort of as a way to meet with people. And that's, you can just come by anytime. I'll just be doing walking meditation or something, so just show up. If I don't immediately respond, I'll be on presently. I already got a couple of people who are probably going to meet me at that time. Digham's is, I think, first on the list.